from Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Thai military warns against anti-coup demonstrations. President Obama makes an unannounced trip to Afghanistan. Pakistani leader to meet new Indian Prime Minister. These stories and more on this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Thailand's military leaders have warned protesters they will not tolerate any further rallies against its coup after a series of clashes between soldiers and protesters across the country Sunday. Army officials warned against further demonstrations, saying protesters would be arrested, jailed, and tried in military court. Soldiers spread out across Bangkok Sunday, including some of the city's busiest shopping areas, sparking scuffles and anger among hundreds of demonstrators. VOA Steve Herman was among the protesters as he describes the scene on the street.
Chants of get out to soldiers in front of a McDonald's in central Bangkok, which has become ground zero for anti-coup protesters. There have been numerous scuffles throughout the day between some of the protesters and soldiers. We have no reports of any injuries at this point, but there has been pushing and shoving at police barricades. It is quite a boisterous crowd. We have seen some of the red shirt organizers. They were the pro-government organizers of protests to the west of Bangkok. Of course, the pro-government and anti-government protesters were shut down after Army Chief General Prayut Chan-o-cha took power, then declared himself Prime Minister, and on Saturday dissolved the Senate, the only legislative body left in Thailand. Steve Herman, VOA News, with the anti-coup protesters in Bangkok.
Steve Herman is on Twitter. You can follow him at W7VOA for news and updates as they happen from Bangkok. General Prayut Chan-o-cha's junta dissolved the kingdom's partly elected Senate on Saturday. That was one day after he named himself prime minister. The army chief says the moves are necessary to restore public order and push through political reforms. The ruling military also announced Saturday it will continue to detain former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra and other ousted government officials for up to a week. The coup has drawn international criticism. The U.S. Defense Department says it is canceling ongoing U.S. military exercises with Thailand, as well as planned visits by U.S. and Thai military officials. Spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said U.S. law and democratic principles require the United States to reconsider its military assistance and engagements. The U.S. State Department also warned U.S. citizens against non-essential travel to the country. Thailand has been racked by 6 months of political disputes and sometimes violent demonstrations. A court ordered Ms. Yingluck to step down earlier this month on charges of nepotism. Thailand's army has staged 12 coups over the last 80 years. Meanwhile, economic analysts are cautiously optimistic over the Thai economic outlook after the military's coup, following 6 months of uncertainty under the weak caretaker government. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok that although a short-term recovery is expected, uncertainty looms over tourism and investment as foreign businesses gauge the political outlook.
Thailand's barometer financial and stock markets reacted cautiously Friday, a day after the Thai army overthrew the caretaker government after months of political conflict. Economists remain cautiously upbeat, hoping longer-term growth can be revived if political stability returns. Vikas Kawatra, Managing Director, Institutional Sales for SCB Securities in Bangkok, says Friday's buying marked a reaction to the months of political infighting in the country.
It opened a bit weak, but we are now down like around 1%. You can't really regard that as any indication of whether foreigners like it or dislike it, because 1% is hardly any reaction either way. The volume is healthy. Locals have been so tired of the whole situation, so they welcome it. And not to forget, local means most Bangkok people, and most Bangkok people have a different view of things.
The Thai economy is facing recession after months of protests, failed elections in February, and political violence that has claimed almost 30 lives and left hundreds injured. A state economic think tank reported the economy shrank by more than 2% in the first quarter of the year from the last 3 months of 2013, as the conflict took its toll on investor and consumer confidence. Director of the Thai Chamber of Commerce University, Thanavat Ponpuchai, says the challenge for Thailand is to move toward longer-term economic stability.
In Thailand right now, I think the big question of Thailand is how can Thai economy grow in a sustainable path?
Yes.
So I think it's very important question. So this group, I think it should make a Thai political situation in the future more stable in the long run. So I think it's quite hard for Thai people and Thai economy and Thai society to get a good solution for Thai politics. So if we have a stable political situation, it will support Thai economic growth in the long run.
Thailand has been without a formal government since December. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Democracy in Hong Kong is a hotly debated topic. We dive into the politics of the Chinese city with a new series beginning shortly on today's Daybreak Asia. President Barack Obama marked America's Memorial Day holiday with an unannounced visit to Afghanistan, where he addressed U.S. troops and met with commanders. He spent 4 hours meeting with troops in Afghanistan before flying to Germany to visit patients at a U.S. military hospital. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that his trip Sunday came as America's combat mission in Afghanistan is ending, and Mr. Obama prepares to speak out on America's future role on the world stage.
I know it's a little late, but I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd stop by.
President Obama said America's longest war has made the nation more secure.
You've helped prevent attacks and save American lives back home. Al-Qaeda is on its heels in this part of the world, and that's because of you.
And helped forge democracy in Afghanistan.
Think about last month's election. Despite all the threats from the Taliban, the Afghan people refused to be terrorized. Millions of Afghans lined up to cast their ballot. And next month's runoff will be another step toward the first democratic transfer of power in the history of this nation.
Mr. Obama noted that challenges remain, including a pending accord defining America's role in Afghanistan after this year.
And with that bilateral security agreement, assuming it is signed, we can plan for a limited military presence in Afghanistan beyond 2014. Because after all the sacrifices we've made, we want to preserve the gains that you have helped to win. And we're going to make sure that Afghanistan can never again, ever, be used again to launch an attack against our country.
With the United States preparing for its first year without troops in combat since 2001, the president will lay out his vision for America's role in the world in an address Wednesday at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Pointing to conflicts from Syria to Ukraine, Mr. Obama's critics have accused him of passivity in the face of mounting threats around the world. The president is expected to make a case for multilateral engagement and diplomacy while keeping U.S. military forces at the ready. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
North and South Korea have exchanged accusations after Navy ships from each side opened fire on the other, raising tensions along their contested maritime border. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Seoul.
North Korea on Friday angrily denied its Navy fired on South Korean ships near their de facto sea border and instead claimed it was the victim of preemptive shelling. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said a North Korean ship fired at a patrol boat near the disputed border, known as the Northern Limit Line, Thursday. The JCS says the boat was not hit and returned fire that also did not hit anything. But Pyongyang's Korean Central Broadcasting Station on Friday read out a statement from the Korean People's Army saying its ships and Chinese ships were the ones shot at. The newsreader says warships of the South Korean puppet navy intruded deep into the waters of the North Korean side. She says the incident happened on the north side of the maritime demarcation line and was a preemptive firing under the pretext of intercepting peaceful Chinese fishing boats. Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-sok says they received a letter Friday from North Korea formally denying any aggression. Through this letter, he says, North Korea argued that yesterday's firing provocation against their ship near Yongpyeong Island was unrelated to them. He says this unreasonable argument is a shameless lie. The KPA statement on North Korean radio said it was preparing to be fully combat ready and would mercilessly wipe out what it called puppet military hooligans keen on provocation. South Korean defense spokesman Kim says they sent their own letter to North Korea, gravely warning it against incitement. He says South Korea has clearly expressed they will firmly respond if North Korea continues to provoke. The South Korean military has strengthened its surveillance and operation posture, he says, and maintains firm readiness against North Korea's various provocations. The alleged exchange of fire raises tensions along the northern limit line, which was established under United Nations command, but North Korea refuses to recognize. Daniel Pinkston is Deputy Northeast Asia Director with the International Crisis Group.
The South has adopted that and claims that is a maritime border, but strictly speaking, according to international law, it's not. In fact, there is no maritime boundary in the area.
Earlier this week, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said South Korea's Navy fired warning shots at three North Korean ships that crossed the maritime border. North Korea claimed it was policing illegal Chinese fishing boats. Pyongyang responded by threatening to strike at all South Korean ships that enter the sensitive waters. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Seoul.
Stay up to date with the latest news on voanews.com/daybreakasia. And if you have a smartphone, download the free VOA mobile app. Leaders of South Asian countries are due in the Indian capital to attend the swearing-in ceremony of India's Prime Minister-elect Narendra Modi. The unprecedented invitations are being seen as a signal that the new Indian leader will focus on improving ties with neighboring countries, including rival Pakistan. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
The sprawling forecourt of the Presidential Palace in New Delhi has been spruced up and tight security put in place for the ceremony in which Bharatiya Janata Party leader Narendra Modi will take the oath as India's Prime Minister Monday evening. The event will be more high-profile than ever before. Among the audience will be the presidents of Sri Lanka, Afghanistan and Maldives, and the Prime Ministers of Pakistan, Bhutan, Nepal and Mauritius. Bangladesh, whose Prime Minister is travelling to Japan, will be represented by its Speaker of Parliament. BJP spokesman Siddharth Nath Singh says the invites, the first of their kind by an Indian Prime Minister, signal the next government's intentions.
It's a good gesture that in the subcontinent, India is ready to work with everybody. Certainly, it adds to the strength of each other if the neighbourhood is strong.
The outreach to South Asian leaders, including Pakistan, took many aback. Mr. Modi has a reputation as a hardliner. His tough campaign rhetoric reinforced fears that he is hawkish. South Asia expert Sukh Diomuni at the Institute of Defence Studies and Analysis in New Delhi says Mr. Modi's bold move in reaching out to India's neighbours even before he formally takes charge is meant to allay such concerns. Muni says it shows that when in power, Mr. Modi will be pragmatic. And although most attention is focused on the olive branch extended to Pakistan, Muni says the initiative is not limited to Islamabad.
In the course of election campaign, there were some harsh words said about some of the neighbors, Pakistan and Bangladesh in particular. There were also fears that because of the BJP's alliance in Tamil Nadu with two of the extremist groups, on Tamil ethnic issue, there may be problems and question marks in Sri Lanka. To that extent, this initiative actually tries to smoothen that feeling. I don't think this is Pakistan specific.
Mr. Modi takes power at a time when India's ties with its neighbours have not always been smooth. Besides troubled relations with Pakistan, there is conflict over issues such as immigration and river sharing with Bangladesh. Concerns of regional Tamil parties over the alleged treatment of the ethnic Tamil minority have held back New Delhi's relations with Sri Lanka. But analysts say that for a leader bent upon boosting economics and trade, closer engagement in South Asia is crucial. The move has also won praise by many who feel India has let China make inroads into the region by not doing enough to address the concerns of its neighbours. Known as Big Brother, India is the biggest country in the region. Unlike previous governments, Mr. Modi's strong mandate will give him the space to forge his own path, unhampered by regional allies or even factions within his own party. Hardliners in the BJP have advocated a tough stance against Islamabad. However, analyst Mooney says the Pakistani Prime Minister's decision to come to New Delhi will give the Indian leader a freer hand in attempting progress on peace with Islamabad.
Modi can also stand up against some of his extremist factions in his political constituency, or even within India. There are security agencies which may not have much interest in resolving issues with Pakistan. And certainly there are extremist Hindu groups. All these sections would be snubbed once Nawaz Sharif comes.
For the time being, Mr. Modi has won praise for signalling that building peace and trust in South Asia will be a priority. But analysts say his gesture will have to be backed up in the days to come with more substantive measures. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Our Daybreak Asia weekly poll has been one of the most active this year. We asked, should the United States intervene militarily in the conflict brewing between China and numerous other nations in the South China Sea? Most of our respondents, more than 63%, said yes, while about 31% said no, and 6% were not sure. Thank you to all in our audience who stopped by at our program page at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia and our VOA Asia Facebook page to take the time to vote. China's top official for Hong Kong affairs has denounced pro-democracy activists who plan to launch an open-ended protest in the city later this year if Beijing rejects their demands for genuine democratic reforms. Hong Kong officials who met with Wang Guangyao in Beijing Friday quoted him as saying the supporters of the Occupy Central protest movement are an extremist minority. Occupy Central activists want Hong Kong voters to be able to nominate candidates for the city's next leadership election in 2017. That's the first time the post will be filled by universal suffrage. But Beijing officials have said Hong Kong's constitution, or basic law, does not give the public a right to nominate candidates. Hong Kong government officials agree and plan to formalize them in a reform package to be submitted to lawmakers by March of next year. That package is likely to find support from Hong Kong's pro-establishment Liberal Party. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin recently spoke with its leader, lawmaker James Tien, and asked him what he thinks should happen in the next reform process.
Well, I guess most of the people's wish is finally there's a chance for the 3.4 million registered voters in Hong Kong to cast a vote for the election of the chief executive. They already have the right to elect legislators like myself, but this will be the first time they can elect the chief executive. And I think this is the priority, because if the election reform bill does not pass, what does that mean? That will mean that we will elect our next chief executive like we did in the old ways, which is the old bill, the one that's passed in 2012. The election will be done by 1,200 members of the election committee.
What are the chances that the various factions in Hong Kong and the government will come to an agreement or a consensus on the way that Hong Kong should elect its next chief executive?
Because an amendment on the election bill is considered to be a very important bill, so it needs the passage of two-thirds of the Legislative Council. Right now, we have 70 members. Two-thirds means we would need something like 47 or 48 members. The sort of pro-government or the pro-Beijing side of the members, including myself, there's only 43. So we need about 5 more votes from the pan-democrats to pass, and they have 27 members. So it's now about the government and the central government to negotiate, to discuss whether there's a way that the pan-democrats will accept a position that would let this pass. We need 5 votes from the 27 pan-democrats.
Well, what specific actions would you like to see Beijing take in the coming months to try to get to a consensus?
I think both sides got to give and take a little bit. The pan-democrats wants the nominating committee to take the position that the entry level is so low that anyone basically in Hong Kong can enter. The Beijing side said that although Hong Kong enjoys a high degree of autonomy, you're not independent. Therefore, whoever wants to run for the chief executive got to be at least patriotic. The pan-democrats argue that they're all patriotic. They're patriotic to China because we're all Chinese. But they're saying that we're not patriotic to the Communist Party. The Beijing will say that, hey, China is now ruled by the Communist Party for 60 years. Everything is going well. So from Beijing's side of view, the party and the country is the same thing. So they want to have a screening process by saying you should not be anti-Communist Party. That sort of very loose description. That's why they're negotiating. But another point that's worth mentioning is under the Basic Law, Armenian Constitution, whoever we elect have to be appointed by Beijing at a final stage. Now, we all realize that it would be disaster if we elect someone at the end, whatever the background is, that Beijing goes to that step and say that, hey, I couldn't accept this guy because he's not patriotic. No one wants to see that. The Liberal Party is basically a business-based party. We just want them to come up with a formula that works. We don't have a strong view. We only have a strong view that we should not status quo, which means to remain the way we were in 2012 and take the one step forward and let the people have a choice. One way we're looking at it is that maybe the pan-democrats can back off a little bit, at least let the first election in 2017 go ahead, let's say without the pan-democrats a candidate. Then after one term in 2022, when the next election come up, that we could improve the system and saying that, okay, after 5 years, everything goes smoothly, then we will let the pan-democrats enter as well. But that's just a suggestion.
Now, I want to ask you about the Occupy Central movement. It's a plan by the pan-democratic camp to block parts of the central business district of Hong Kong Island to put pressure on the government to accept its ideas for democratic reform. How acceptable is that kind of protest for you and the business community?
Well, on the Occupy Central, why are we concerned? Because that's where all our major banks are, our foreign financial institutions are. Basically, what this Occupy Central all about is they just want to have a sit-in. They just want to sit in Central like they want to sit in the whole area of Wall Street. And they're not going to be violent. They just say, I'm going to sit there. And now, of course, what our government is concerned and the business community would be concerned, that it probably will be broadcast by worldwide TV, including CNN, BBC, and that would have negative impact on Hong Kong's sort of image. But whether they will actually cripple the financial institutions, I'm sure we all know nowadays the financial institutions run everything by internet, telecommunication, that sort of thing. You don't really need people physically delivering things, walking around in the streets in Central. But still, we're concerned about that.
Hong Kong Liberal Party leader James Tien speaking with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin. In the coming days, we'll bring you Michael's interviews with the leaders of two Hong Kong pro-democracy parties who explain why they support Occupy Central and oppose any screening or vetting of chief executive candidates. You have the right to continue to occupy the space you're in right now and stay tuned for the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.